Dr. Carol Falk was raised in Maryland. She was interested in attending medical school, so she got a bachelor's degree in zoology, but then discovered that she had an interest in marine science, which led her to earn a master's degree in that subject. She started a PhD program in biological oceanography when she decided to attend veterinary school. She earned her veterinary degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1997. While a veterinary student, she was introduced to veterinary acupuncture by one of her anesthesia professors. After graduation, she completed an internship in small animal practice at the Friendship Hospital for Animals. Afterwards, she moved to Florida and worked as an associate in small animal practices and began to study holistic medicine. She was certified in veterinary acupuncture by IVUS in 2001, followed by Chinese herbal medicine, Tui Na, and Chinese food therapy by Qi University. During this time, she founded one of the first integrated veterinary clinics in Florida, the Friendship Animal Wellness Center. Dr. Falk sold her Florida practice and established her current mobile practice, Petwise, in Cleveland, Georgia in 2012. A client introduced Dr. Falk to essential oils and aromatherapy, and she completed a course offered by the Pacific Institute of Aromatherapy in 2017. Dr. Falk has been active in the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association and currently serves as the chair of the conference program committee. Please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Carol Falk as we discuss her education, introduction to holistic medicine, practice history, and the essential oils course that she teaches for CIVT. Dr. Falk, it's great to talk to you today.
Hi, Neil. It's great to speak with you also.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up briefly in Baltimore, Maryland. I was born there and then moved to Rockville, Potomac, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, D.C.
Spent most of your young years there then?
I did, in a great multicultural environment with lots of really cool activities, museums. Yeah, it was a great area to grow up in.
Oh, that sounds nice. So when you had an interest in animals, but I know veterinary medicine kind of came later. What got you interested in going off to college?
It did. So it's a bit of a long story with a lot of zigzags. So I started out pre-med, just had a long-standing internal interest for I don't know what reason in medicine. I was really fascinated with medicine. And I've probably said this on another podcast somewhere, but I had this childhood wish that I would need to have my appendix removed because I wanted to have it in a jar sitting on a shelf in my room so that I could look at it and examine it. And I also just wanted to see what it was like to be in the hospital.
Wow. And, all right.
Then, let's see, then, so I went to college, I was pre-med, and the first zigzag happened when I enrolled in a class with a famous marine biologist. Her name is Dr. Eugenie Clark. She was one of the founders of Moat Marine Lab in South Florida. She got to dive with Jacques Cousteau. She did all kinds of really fascinating work. And so I ended up enrolling in an honors course at University of Maryland, where I was an undergraduate, called Sharks and Their Relatives with her, Dr. Eugenie Clark. She was the instructor. And it was just really fascinating. And I went up to her one day after class and I said, I'm really loving this class. Is there anything else that I can do? How can I become more involved? And she said, sure, go sign up for scuba diving, get your scuba certification, and you can come with me to the Red Sea. And that just sounded like such an amazing opportunity. So I went and took scuba diving class and became certified and went with her to the Red Sea with several other individuals. We had all kinds of interesting research projects. Ironically, her nickname is a shark lady. And literally almost every time she went diving, she would come back up with these crazy shark stories. But in all the time I was diving with her, I never saw a shark.
Oh, geez. So I get it back. So were you comfortable in the water when you decided to do the scuba thing?
So I'm an Aquarius, and I've always been more comfortable in the water than on land. And the other people I was diving with would always tease me. I think some of them were actually a little bit jealous because, you know, when you go diving, most people tend to use a certain amount of air. So there's, depending on your depth that you're diving, you'll calculate how long your tank is good for. And I just was so comfortable in the water, and I think my heart rate and respiratory rate were so low that I could stay down there for a lot longer than most people.
You were calm. I get this. Mm. I also learned how to dive when I was in high school, and so I can appreciate that. So it must have been a lot easier for with you being comfortable in the water to just to pick up the whole scuba thing, you know, to be comfortable with the gear and being under and everything, and to go to the Red Sea right away. Oh my gosh, what a blessing.
Yeah, I'm really glad I had that experience. And with her, and she had connections with National Geographic photographers, and she had a bit of a fan club. I actually got to go on a live-in dive boat with her. That was later when I was doing a master's program, but for a week. And she had all kinds of really, really interesting projects.
Wow. So at one point, did you change your major then?
So I changed my major, and then after I got my bachelor's degree in zoology, I ended up working with her as my advisor, and I got a master's degree in oceanography.
And after that, what happened?
Then after that, I decided I wanted to pursue a PhD in oceanography. So I found a program that was compatible with my interests, and I moved to South Florida. And I started doing research, and I realized that my experience with Dr. Eugenie Clark was somewhat unique, that most people don't get to have an advisor that has an entourage and National Geographic photographers, and that career really wasn't as glamorous as maybe I had initially thought. And so I was doing research on a benthic amphipod, which is a crustacean that lives at the bottom of the water. But my research in Florida involved those organisms as a sentinel for the quality of the water. And so I was diving at wastewater output sites and you know, not like the beautiful Red Sea. And then in addition, I was spending a lot of time in a lab, and I kind of my balance is somewhere really in the middle between introvert and extrovert. And I think that was a little too introverted. I just realized that I really didn't want to spend my career just in a lab. I wanted something more interactive. Mm-hmm. So I kind of drifted back to medicine and my passion for medicine. And when I put all those things together that were the things that I really loved and my strengths, just led me to veterinary medicine.
There's a lot of different ways you could have gone with the training you'd had and the interests and everything. And so, all right. So were you looking at, aquatic medicine?
I looked into it. So, I don't know if the listeners are familiar or not, but there is or was a program. I went to veterinary school at University of Pennsylvania. There was a program available, I believe, to all first and second year veterinary students called AquaVet. And it is a program at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And it was very competitive, and I think my oceanography background definitely gave me an edge. So I was real fortunate to get into that program. And the first year was a general introduction to aquatic animal medicine. And then the second year was really specific to aquatic animal histopathology. And then my fourth year, I did a rotation on aquatic animal medicine at Prince Edward Island. And I was going somewhat in that direction, but I really Mess up my desire to have, you know, more of an interactive career and a clinical medicine career. The fish medicine and shrimp medicine, it was really more of agricultural. And I really wanted to be working with the individual patient. And the other issue was geographic. So it looked like I would have to move to Ecuador or Thailand, or there were a couple of other places that really were not, just wasn't really one of my desires to move.
Gotcha. So when you were doing the Aquavet thing, was that on school breaks, like summertime?
That was summertime.
Yeah. Okay. So successive summers, you were going up to Woods Hole and,
yeah.
and then to Canada. So where did your interest turn to then?
So I looked at some different small animal practices, and I'm fairly academic. I still consider myself fairly academic. So I ended up accepting an internship position, a small animal medicine internship at a place called Friendship Hospital for Animals in Washington, D.C. So it was close to my family. It was close to where I grew up. And so I did that for a year. And then I ended up moving to South Florida and working at a couple of different practices.
Did you go into the internship with the idea that you wanted just more education, or were you really, did you think about specializing at that point?
I did think about specializing for a little while in dermatology. I do also love dermatology. I was kind of consider myself a derm geek in school. I think I did like 3 dermatology rotations. We only had to do one, and so I would just go and hang out in the dermatology wards a lot. But I had already been in school for so long, and so it was just time for me to go into a work environment.
Yeah, I bet. You know, after all that postgraduate work you'd done prior to vet school, I suppose, I imagine it gave you a good perspective on school while you were in it. And then, you know, kind of you're able to probably sort through options a lot easier than someone who hadn't had that life experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad I had all those experiences and that I didn't get, you know, pinned down on a career path. So I think a lot of people, young people, you know, feel like you have this pressure to make a decision and don't realize that it's okay to change your mind, and it's okay to change your mind multiple times.
It really worked for you, you know, kind of you pivot here, pivot there, and you were still making forward motion though.
I did. And I really feel passionate about my decision and about being a small animal veterinarian, and having explored all those other paths, I think, to give me, you know, more confidence that this is a really compatible career for me.
So you went into practice in Florida then. How did that go?
So that went pretty well. I worked for a couple of different people, and then I ended up taking a class on the Veterinary Information Network, VIN. I had an interest. I think it was probably sparked by a 1-hour lecture in veterinary school by an anesthesia professor on acupuncture. And this is way back, so it was really unusual at the time to have any exposure to acupuncture in a veterinary curriculum, right? Yeah. So this guy was really like cutting edge. I think his name was Dr. Alan Clyde. So thank you, Dr. Clyde.
And, oh, sure. I remember reading his papers. You know, he was one of the first to publish on it. Yeah. Okay.
Really?
That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
So he really sparked my interest. So I took this like introduction to alternative veterinary medicine on VIN. And, you know, like most of us that are in integrative veterinary medicine, we just get sucked in, right? It's like, wow, this is fascinating. There's this whole world, you know, that you don't know about to explore and to learn. And so I got sucked in. I didn't go to China or anything like that to study, but I wanted to learn more and more and more. So then I ended up leaving. I tried to speak with the owner of the practice that I was in and explain all this to him, my desires. And he was really not interested at all. You know, this is a conventional practice and we're not going to do that. We're not offering acupuncture. And so I thought, okay, well, it's time for me to leave. So with a lot of encouragement from clients who were actually really, really supportive when I started talking about alternative medicine, I ended up opening my own practice in South Florida. And I think it was actually one of the first holistic veterinary practice in South Florida.
And you just, from scratch, you just opened it right up?
From scratch. And I was really concerned that I wouldn't have enough clients. So, you know, I opened it as an integrative medicine practice. So we still did conventional medicine. We did diagnostic testing. We did do vaccinations. You know, we did all the conventional medicine, but I also offered acupuncture. And then as I started studying and I obtained more certifications and I started using Chinese herbs and Western herbs and flower essences. And so, you know, I would incorporate all those modalities into the practice.
So acupuncture training was first?
Acupuncture training was first.
Yeah. Through IVUS, as I recall.
That was kind of a foundation through IVUS. And then I ended up doing, I think, just about all of the modules that Qi Institute was offering at the time. So when I was introduced to Qi Institute and Dr. Shea, the scenario was that fortunately, I could drive like 3 or 4 hours because it was in Gainesville, Florida. So that was really attractive. It would drive up. It was a very small hotel. There was no Qi farm. We'd drive up, very small hotel, and we would meet in the conference room, really like 10 or 15 of us around a table at the hotel. And usually the last night, Dr. Shea would take everyone out to dinner, some Asian restaurant. And it was really small. It was just a wonderful learning opportunity, really warm environment, and just a lot of support. And I know now, I haven't been down there recently, but it's just grown exponentially.
Well, they've done a wonderful job there, that's for sure. So did you kind of settle into a cohort of people that you'd attend all these modules with? Did you keep in touch? And
I kept in touch with some of the people. Some of the people I met were back for the different modules, but I met lots of different people. And then, so I went through all the herbals. So there were the 5 herbal modules. And then I went through and got certified in Tui Na and in food therapy. I had a friend of mine from veterinary school. We were study partners and we ended up doing the food therapy certification together.
Nice. And what sparked your interest in essential oils?
That's another interesting story. I had a client who came in. I think she was attracted to the holistic nature of the practice. And she came in and she already had quite a bit of training and experience with essential oils, both for people and for animals. And she came in and she also happens to be very good at making really delicious baked goods. So if you know, like the typical veterinary practice has no food. I mean, we would like everyone just get really excited if a rep would come in and offer to buy a pizza, right? So she would come in with these beautiful desserts. So, you know, like lemon squares and brownies and cakes. And she immediately found my weaknesses and she used them to her advantage. So she would come in and then she would also come in with this bottle of an essential oil product and, oh, you have to try this, you know, here's a free sample. So I would try them and she'd come back and every time she came back, she would bring more of the goodies and she started bringing her animals in and, you know, she brought a cat in. I think a couple of the pets that she brought in are actually in my case studies from some of my presentations, but she brought a cat in with an external parasite. And when I told her about it and I suggested the conventional medication, she was like, oh, no, we're going to fix this with essential oils. And at the time, it was really early on in my career in essential oils. It was probably 15 to 20 years ago. And I was really skeptical. And she would take the cat home and she documented everything. she would bring the cat back and it would be all cured. And I'd say, Denny, what did you do? Oh, I used, you know, thieves and I used some frankincense and I diffused this and I did that. I'm like, wow. And then she brought a dog in who needed, it was a greyhound, you know, and as we know, they usually have a propensity for periodontal disease. So she brought this dog in and we knew that she was going to need a lot of extractions. This dog's name is Honey. And so Denny wanted to come back and she wanted to put essential oils in her mask to help her relax, you know, before we intubated her. And then she had all these blends made up and she had them all labeled. And she said, you know, Dr. Falk, I want you to put this one when you extract the tooth. I want you to put this one up into her gums. And I want you to rub this one on her mouth when we're finished. And you know, I want you to do this. And honestly, I really thought that she was out there, way out there. And I just was really worried that something terrible was going to happen and she was going to end up suing me. But I didn't want to insult her because I let her stop bringing in all of the baked goods. And she was really nice. She's a really nice person. She became a really close friend of mine. So she brought this dog in and we ended up doing 12 or 13 extractions. And the sedation went very well. So whatever she did, whatever we did, helped Honey relax, and intubation, no problem. And she was maintained on anesthesia really well. We did the extractions. We used all the essential oils like she told us to. We put them actually like into the alveoli when we extracted the teeth. And then when Honey was awake, I brought her into an examination room. I still remember Denny and I sitting in the room with Honey wrapped in her blanket. And we extubated her and she woke up and I said, no, Denny, she's going to need antibiotics because we did all these extractions. And she said, oh no, Dr. Falk, I don't need antibiotics. I have essential oils. And I'm thinking, oh great. Okay. I'm going to get sued. And then I said, okay, well, surely like you want to take home some pain medication for Honey, right? Oh no, I don't need that either. I have essential oils. And I really, really thought she was crazy. So I said, okay, well, if you're not going to take home antibiotics and you're not going to take home any pain medication for Honey, please call me. I need you to call me as soon as you get home. I need you to call me when she's awake and she's probably not going to eat today. I need you to call me back tomorrow and I need you to bring her in. I think it was like 3 days so I can check all of her extraction sites. So, you know, I forget about this. I go on to see the rest of my patients. And a few hours later, I get this email with the picture, and it's Honey with her face like buried in a bowl of food. Oh. And she had literally like no bleeding, and her recovery was just completely uneventful.
That's a story. Wow. So you decided to do
all
some training.
Experiences, yeah? You know, and they kept turning out positive. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to keep going. So I guess this is my calling. I guess I need to keep going. And I really, like I said, I have a very academic brain. So I really just kept wanting to learn more. You know, how does this work? Why does this work? And how can I help more patients?
How did you select the training program that you attended?
Both of those, Ivis and Chi Institute, were within driving distance. And yeah. I really felt drawn to Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
And so both of those were just kind of no-brainer.
But how about the essential oil training?
So the essential oil training, I definitely credit Denny with a lot of encouragement. And after I saw these cases and after I saw her successes, and she was telling me about more successes that she had with her own pets. And then I went on and I ended up taking a class locally in South Florida and using a lot of the oils on myself. And then I ended up doing more training. And then eventually I had some other mentors. I had someone that actually is usually a vendor at the AHVMA, the Holistic Veterinary Medical Association annual conference, offered if I would come and help her with her booth, she would pay for my airfare and my hotel room. I said, okay, I'll try it. So I came and met her and I helped her with her booth. I was already using some of her products. And so she's been, that's Faith Thanis. And so with Silk Road Oil, and she's been a really big, mentor for me. She still is. She knows a tremendous amount. She spent a lifetime studying essential oils, both for people and for animals.
That's wonderful. So I know you're not in Florida any longer. So how did that change occur?
So after 12 years in practice in South Florida, I sold my practice. I just was really ready to make a change. I didn't necessarily want to go all the way back up the East Coast to the DC area. So I had visited a friend in this beautiful area of Georgia that I didn't even know existed. It's near the start of the Appalachian Trail, and it's just gorgeous, really heavily forested, lots of hiking, lots of waterfalls. And came up here, just fell in love with it. And the week before, I believe it was the week before I was supposed to move up here to Georgia, I got a fortune cookie, and my fortune said, "Life's a mountain, not a beach."
Well, that spells it out for you, doesn't it?
So that helps with my decision.
Was it difficult to find someone to buy your practice?
It was not. I was actually approached. So I had built the practice up to such a level. I don't know what other people's experiences are. I know of at least one other holistic veterinarian. I'm sure there are many that have worked with corporate practices. And so I had one of the corporate practices approach me and offer to buy my practice and to keep it like an East meets West style. And so we did that, and I know others are finding success in that environment, even though there can be some really extreme challenges.
Good. So that sets you up to just start fresh again in Georgia from scratch, right?
That set me up to start fresh. And honestly, I just was really attracted to the environment. I really didn't have a great business plan. When I moved here, I thought, well, I'll just move here and then I'll figure something out later. And fortunately, it worked.
And what sort of practice did you set up there?
So the practice that I had in South Florida was a 3,000 square foot full service practice with boarding and grooming and, you know, all of that surgery, all of that. And I found that rewarding, but at the same time, very stressful. And so I was seeking a little bit of a lifestyle change where I had more balance, more work-life balance. And so I decided, it seemed like there was a niche here for a house call practice. I just didn't see anything in this area. And so I just jumped in, bought a truck, and started a house call practice.
Doing conventional medicine as well, or... Only
doing both,
medicine.
But really more of an integrative medicine model. So I think my whole approach, my whole philosophy at that point had changed. So even though all of my clients may not be completely integrative, I still, you know, do vaccine risk assessment. I don't practice like the way I did initially when I graduated.
And if I have my math right, you're about 10 years in there, yeah?
Up here, this is going on year 12.
Okay. Okay. So at what point did you become involved with the AHVMA? You've been a critical part of the conference committee, but when did you start attending those meetings and when did you get more involved in the group?
So I started attending the meetings a long time ago, probably 15 plus years ago. And I was, I guess I was still exhibiting more of my introvert side. So I was like the kind of conference attendee that probably a lot of you are, where you just go sit in the back of the room, you know, you highlight your little conference schedule and go, okay, I want to go to this talk. And I sat in the back of the room and I took notes. I went and I saw the vendors, I talked to the vendors, and I left. And then at one point there was an advertisement that they were looking for moderators. And so I talked to the person that was in charge of the moderators, and I thought, oh, this might be a really interesting opportunity to just get to know a different side of the organization and maybe meet some of the lecturers, because I would never have really dreamed of going up and talking to the lecturers. I was, like I said, sitting in the back of the room, and maybe I might email them a question. Maybe if I really had a burning question, I might go up on a break and ask a question, but I wasn't going to raise my hand in front of everybody and ask a question. So I decided to be a moderator. And as a moderator, your job is to get up and introduce the speaker. And so I would really never consider myself a good public speaker. That was honestly was always kind of a fear. I tried to conquer it in high school, but it really went like horribly wrong. That's another funny story. And so I started doing the moderating, and it was a really great experience. And I was approached and asked to be on the conference program committee, which is a small group, volunteer group that looks at all of the lecture submissions for lecture and lab submissions for the year for the conference, and then goes through and evaluates all of those and then selects the speakers, as well as training and organizing the moderators. So I got involved, and there was a leadership change there. And so I had an opportunity to just kind of step in. So that kind of morphed into a chair position.
Which you still hold.
I do.
Yes. Well, thank you for your service, by the way. I have a similar outlook. I'm a back row attendee. And I agree, moderating is a great way to get involved in a group, especially.
Guess it's like a gateway, right? For me, it was like a gateway to like getting over that fear. It's still not, honestly, it's not comfortable for me to get up and speak in front of a lot of people. Now, I can get up and talk in front of 10 or 15 clients and do a lecture, and that feels pretty comfortable. But then to get up in front of 100 of your peers is a really different scenario.
It sure is. It sure is. Well, I do want to thank you for your service to the AH family, because your help has been invaluable on the conference program committee.
And thank you as well. I know you've been really, really involved in the organization.
But now we can't leave without pivoting a little bit and talking about what I think is probably your latest venture is creating a course for CIVT.
Yeah, that's been really exciting. So it started out as a couple of webinars, and thank you, Neil, for encouraging me to get involved. So I've been really impressed with the organization, with CIVT and how much they do. And I honestly did not really know a lot about them, but I was really excited. So hopefully, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about essential oils. And so my experience has been, if you're really passionate about something, it makes it a lot easier to conquer your fears, you know, whether that's public speaking or whatever. So I was invited initially to give a webinar, actually two webinars, and then the second webinar evolved into a 6-part course. And although I will say that it has been a lot more work and more of a time investment than I had envisioned, it's also been really, really rewarding. And I think really with the help of a lot of people, some of them whom I probably don't even recognize, but a lot of people at CIVT and the background that they've put together and the kind of the backbone, the website, the whole structure of these courses, it has been really rewarding. It's a very extensive course. So it encompasses a lot of my prior lectures. I'm constantly doing PubMed searches. I'm constantly reading articles on essential oils. The literature on essential oils has skyrocketed. So it's really difficult to keep up with it. It's challenging to keep up with it, and it goes in all different directions. So in human medicine, I think there is a big, there's a big increase in literature on essential oils and analgesia, essential oils and anxiety, essential oils and well-being. There are some incredible programs that have been put in place in different human medical institutions, including oncology centers. A lot of the initiative has come from the nursing community, and they've put together some amazing coursework for RNs and other human healthcare practitioners. And there was one article I read actually suggesting an essential oils course for anesthesiology students. So if you've ever seen my slides or my presentations, I have a couple of these little slides that are like my vision for veterinary medicine and my sort of crystal ball, like my predictions for the future. And one of them is that we would have an essential oils class or multiple essential oils class offerings for veterinary students.
Well, I know that this was a ton of work to put this course together, but I felt like you were a great person for this what an opportunity for you to spread your knowledge really on a worldwide platform. You know, you get this foundation laid out, like you said, it can be altered as you go along, and now it's set and people can access it and just benefit from all your years of experience benefit from it. So I'm really happy that you were able to take this on and put in the work, because we're all going to benefit from it.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. I think a lot of veterinarians, some of us are familiar with essential oils, and I think a lot of people are using essential oils for themselves, and now they're more familiar because they're more readily available. But I think there's a huge opportunity to educate the veterinary community about essential oils and how they really fit seamlessly into veterinary practice. I mean, I agree. you don't have to give any pills. People usually love them. The pets respond really well. I could go on and on for hours about essential oil safety. So I know that's a big issue. There's a lot of misinformation out there, a lot of rumors and things floating around. But generally, essential oils are very safe to use with animals, and there's some options like hydrosols and other things to make them safer. But they treat body, mind, and spirit. And so I think they really, really like epitomize a holistic medicine model. And they, once you start using in your practice, I think it's really difficult to work without them.
I agree. Carol, before I let you go, just one more thing in listening to your last little bit there, do you feel like your location living in the foothills of the Appalachians just kind of sets you up spiritually to work with the oils? I mean, I'm toward the northern end of the Appalachians, so I do feel a connection to the land, to the topography and the flora and fauna, so to speak, and that to me helps with herbal medicine and essential oils and that sort of thing. Do you think it's helped that flourish in you being there rather than say in Florida?
I think so, for sure. I think the environment here, I can walk out my door. I feel like I'm in a retreat. I can walk out my door literally onto a self-made hiking trail. And just being out there, among the pine trees and the hemlocks, the rhododendrons, the mountain laurel, just to have all that and breathing some of those essential oils in is certainly motivating. And I think a lot of us, once you start practicing any kind of herbal medicine, maybe any kind of holistic medicine, but certainly any kind of herbal medicine, I think you develop more of a connection with nature, with the trees, with the plants. And I think there's definitely a conversation that goes on, at some level. with the practitioner and then the plants.
Very good. Carol, I'm so glad that we were able to do this. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you've been extremely busy with organizing the conference and of course, this essential oils course for CIVT. So I really appreciate you being able to talk to you today.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it as well.
Hope to see you in person again soon. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of the College of Integrative Veterinary Therapies. CIVT provides world-leading education in natural medicine, including 3 accredited postgraduate qualifications, industry-recognized certifications, and a wide range of evidence-based courses and webinars delivered by qualified and experienced practitioners. By bridging cutting-edge science and tradition, CIVT helps you to expand your treatment options to tackle your most challenging cases. And whether you're a veterinarian, veterinary technician or nurse, animal health professional, or someone who wants to learn more, they have the right course for you. Investigate their offerings at civtedu.org. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd appreciate if you take the time to tell a friend and to give us a favorable rating on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for your support. We'll see you next time.